You're on Groove 107.7 FM, and today I'm talking with Nikki Hager, who has just written a wonderful book called Other People's Wars, New Zealand in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the War on Terror. Welcome, Nikki.
Hello.
All right, okay, so this is another fairly full-on book here. It's fairly in-depth. I have to ask, first of all, where did this book come from?
Well, I wrote a few stories for the Sunday Star Times early in the 2000s. That's early in the War on Terror, when New Zealand had just got to Afghanistan and no one knew what the SAS was doing. And I managed to find some sources and I talked to some of the people who'd been on the ground. But that was when I became aware that it was like we'd gone to war and no one was being told most of what was going on. And even I, with those first articles, only knew vague generalizations of what was happening. And so it was one of those subjects where I thought, if I could find enough sources and if I could do it, someone really should be writing about this, because it's crazy that a whole country doesn't know about what the government's doing in a war.
Well, that's true. And one of the messages that I see here that's coming out is there seems to be a disconnect between what some of our top brass in the military are doing and what they believe and what the ministers over the two, three successful governments are all saying and their position on various aspects of our international military relations.
Yeah, I think there's a reason for this. I think that the big driving politics of the last 10 years have been that the people in charge of foreign affairs and defence, which most people know nothing about and don't think about, frankly, but the people in charge of that actually have pretty different views from the rest of the country. I'll give you an example. When New Zealand, when the world approached the Iraq War back in 2003, in New Zealand, practically everybody was against it. And I'm talking about widespread, even in the ACT Party and the National Party, 80-something percent of people felt that we shouldn't be part of it unless it was the United Nations. So that's a very strong consensus.
Well, that's true.
And at the same time, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was strongly pushing the Labour government to join. In other words, they were not in the same place as the rest of the public. And same with the senior defence officials. They were just dying to be there. And it wasn't because they thought there were weapons of mass destruction or that they hated Saddam Hussein. The reason they wanted to be there was they saw it as a golden opportunity to get closer to the United States. In other words, their agendas were more important than what the rest of the country was feeling about the war. And that was a dramatic case of the politics which had played out in different ways through those 10 years.
Well, what was the driver between trying to get, you know, closer with the Americans? Was it trade?
Oh, now, this is a very interesting question, because I actually think that there's a large extent to which it's not even rational. Because if you look at a country like Australia, which has the closest, most embarrassingly kind of obedient relations with military relations with the United States, it doesn't help them in their trade. They got a free trade agreement before New Zealand, and actually when people looked at it, it wasn't really worth having it. It made no difference to their economy. So I don't think that's the real reason. I think it's a more complex one about senior people who were really, they sort of felt left out. They felt demeaned and second-class citizens when New Zealand's nuclear policy got them shut out of ANZUS. And rather than adapting, which the rest of the country did, and we got into peacekeeping and we played a different kind of role for a tiny little 4 million person state, they've just always wanted to get back there. And that's been their kind of main foreign policy agenda.
Well, that seems really interesting, because the even down to the, you know, the World Cup that's currently going on at the moment, there's this clean green image, which we argue over, obviously, but at least we're arguing about it. And all that's the anti-nuclear thing is very strong. Foreigners believe, and when they come here, they look for that the evidence on that. So,
and they believe that we're an independent country. That
yes.
We're not just a slavish little ally. And the funny thing is, that's actually where the country is going, because our national identity is wrapped around that independence.
Mm.
But, you know, if people who are listening to this and other New Zealanders, the truth is, we don't know practically anything that Foreign Affairs says or does on our behalf when they're talking in other countries. We don't know most of what my book shows is that we don't know most of what the military was doing through those 10 years either. And so it was possible for them to run their own agenda, which wasn't the independent, nuclear-free, clean, green New Zealand kind of one, which most of the rest of the country has adopted. adopted so much, it was the how can we get back as close as we possibly can, was more or less the guiding principle.
Great. And tell me, there is a term that constantly keeps coming up in the book, and that's a jargon term. It's called interoperability. What is that about?
This is, if you're a military person, this sounds like complete common sense. Their exercises, the equipment they buy, the training they have, nearly all has as part of its goal interoperability. And this is the ability to seamlessly, as they say it, slip into an allied coalition, which really means a British-American-led coalition. And so the equipment we have, our communications gear, the way we train, the way we talk about it, the structures within our military are designed. And this goes right back to the First World War and beyond, so that we can be a little bit off the big powers' forces. So to a military person, that just makes sense because that's always what they want. For a New Zealander, it's actually quite an offensive term. It's as if to say that the whole basis on which we have defence forces is so they can be given to other people, which in the South African wars in 1900, yes, certainly, First World War, yes, Second World War, pretty much, although people were starting to have doubts. Vietnam War, very doubtful. And so that term, as you say, it symbolises a difference about where we're going and who we think we are.
So you get that split, and I noticed that was true at the early stages of the Iraq War, when the Clark government, and Clark in particular, was rewriting various MOUs to say these engineers that she was sending, the light engineers she was sending at the time, were there as a clean-up role.
They were not part of the occupation forces. She kept writing that in the documents, and the officials kept making it so that actually they were part of the occupation forces.
Yeah.
This is the fight that's been going on, even when it requires them to disobey the orders of their prime minister and government. So it's been, the politics of it are fascinating.
Yeah, well, that struck me as being interesting, that term of command and control, that there's two different things. I would have thought if you're commanded by your brigadier or whoever it is that's at the top line, you do what they say, not... But, of course, you know, if you're being shot at in the middle of Basra somewhere, you have to do what's practical at the time.
Yeah, what the public was told in deployment after deployment, because we've had a very large number of deployments to Afghanistan and we had this one to Iraq, but each time the government and the Defence Force know how people feel, and so this little deception went on. They told people what they knew that they wanted to hear. They said that these forces remain entirely, 100% under the command of the New Zealand military. What they didn't explain, as you've alluded to, is that there's a difference in the military between command and control. Command is a technical situation. It means that the ultimate control, the ultimate discipline, sits with the New Zealand government. But they delegate what this thing called control, which is that they basically, foreigners tell them everything they're going to do, all their priorities, and order them around, and they're as good as being part of the foreign forces. And that's what happened with deployment after deployment.
And that's followed a pattern at the time. And one of the things that strikes me as being rather interesting, particularly recently, has been the amount of media that's come out about individual soldiers, particularly SAS, who I thought were secret, but apparently not, when they're shot or injured or they've been given a VC or something, they're on the front page of the Don Post.
Yes.
What's going on there? What's that about?
It's a bit of a joke, really. It is that we never, ever, ever comment on security matters except when we want to because it looks good for our public relations strategy. That's more or less what it is. And so what I found was, one of the really important things I found and put into some chapters of the book is that the SAS people in Afghanistan were not happy with what they were seeing and what they were being asked to do quite often. And they were reporting this up the chain and it was not being acted on because there were people whose political agendas meant that they wanted to have them there. And that's why, as happens in a democracy, they ended up talking to people like me, because that was their outlet for doing it.
Mm. And from that, you've put together the evidence on this one. I can remember a couple of weeks ago when this book was released, there was an immediate reaction about the American New Zealand Post in Bamiyan and about the swapping of CIA secrets and things like that. That was the focus.
Yeah, let me explain this because it's just a funny little story about the media.
Yeah.
So a large book comes out, and it is a large book. It covers many different subjects. And the first journalist to write a story noted that I had said in Chapter 17 that there was a secret CIA facility located inside the Kiwi base in Bamiyan, which is where the main army base that New Zealand runs or hopes to run inside Afghanistan. And because that was mentioned first, the rest of the book was ignored for a couple of days, and there was just this to and fro of people saying, I don't think that's true. I think that's true. I always knew that. It's never not true. There was this huge fight around this tiny little issue, which is actually like almost a footnote in the book. It's not a major issue there. It happens to be the case that there are these undeclared intelligence officers who help to, again, control our soldiers there. Just as one part of how we don't get told what's going on was why I had it in the book. Mm. But actually, the book is much, as you will know, it's much wider and deeper than that. It's about all kinds of things we did in the developing politics of the Afghanistan war and what the war was like, because most people won't understand what the war was like. It's about who we were fighting and why we were fighting them. It's about the intelligence deployments. It's about all sorts of things. So I just had to roll my eyes when there was a little flurry of denials and confirmations and so what's about this issue of the CIA base inside Bamiyan.
Yeah, it seems like almost a red herring as a way of just keeping the matter quiet.
I don't know what was going on. I think it might have just been it was easier to talk about one thing than to read the book.
That did strike me as interesting, as the number of people that I've already mentioned, and I said, well, I'm talking to you, and there's been a dividing line, and I've said, well, you know, how do you divide a line when you haven't actually read it or read a decent review? And I point to the one that's in Scoop, for example. Well, at least that gave me some background.
Mm.
Yeah, which was interesting. And there seems to be the way that people react to various things, particularly when there's definite apathy around things.
Well, to be fair to people, we can't all read every book when it comes out, and we believe people. We, you know, we've got people who we tend to believe. So John Key says, I haven't read it, and it's stupid, and it's all made up. And people who believe John Key will actually probably just think it's stupid and I made it up. And there were some journalists who were dismissive of it and said, I've had a trip to Afghanistan and I already knew all this, or it's not true or whatever, and were dismissive of it. And there were other ones and who were very complimentary of it. And so it kind of depends who you listen to. And it's not very satisfying in my position, because I know that there'll be quite a lot of people who will think I'm wrong without ever seeing it. But what can I do? I know. Mm. I don't own the newspapers.
That's true. So what is the key message that you're trying to put across in this book?
Can I say there were two things. The most important one was that anyone who reads it will actually understand about a whole war, the longest war, longest foreign war in our history. It's very important that we know what goes on in our name.
Mm.
And anyone who reads it will understand that, and they will know about what it's like inside the Navy and what it's like inside the Army and the SAS and how they think and what they do, which is incredibly valuable. My other purpose for it, which is the longer-term one, is that it's about New Zealand. You know, this isn't a shock horror story about all the bad things that someone did, even though there were some horrible parts of the war.
There certainly was.
I think that the New Zealanders come out looking pretty good in most of it.
Mm.
I think it's actually a story about who we are as a country. A lot of the politics about the conflict between how foreign affairs wanted to use it in U.S. relations compared to what the public and the soldiers wanted, I think it's all about who we are and where we're going as a country. And those are issues that we should be thinking about and caring about.
Great. Well, thanks you for summarising that really well. Is there anything that you would like to see come out of this? I mean, is it a report or some investigation or something?
Oh, if I was completely unrealistic, I would say that the Defence Force should have a huge inquiry, because there are so many things in this where they should be concerned about their own officers misleading politicians, hiding things from the public, bending the rules. There's one side of it which is that. But actually, I've got a much more modest and important wish with the book, and that is that some people read it. Some people who are interested in these things, or who latently are interested and care about the country, read it. And if some people do that, I'll be more than happy.
That's a good place to finish. Now, what are you going to be doing next?
When you work on a book like this, which in the end was 5 years' work, you do not rashly start another one. I'll just be thinking, wow.
take a nice big rest.
Yeah.
Interesting that it came out just before the World Cup. Was it intentional?
Oh, well, I could tell you the story because it was a difficult book to choose the timing for. I didn't want to. I was hoping to finish it last year, but just didn't get the work done. And so I ran the risk of people saying, hey, it's an election book. You know, he's trying to influence the election or something, which it truly, totally isn't at all.
Yeah.
And so I wondered, when can I have it? And the best bet seemed to be to time it with the 10th anniversary of September 11, which was a kind of a nice focus time, which...
Well, that's what starts the book.
It was also when the World Cup was being launched, so I was, you know, I just had to jump into the middle of that.
Yeah. So you think you'll build some momentum after the World Cup's finished and look at it from that again so it doesn't get lost?
The way that books work, I'll probably go on the book tour later, but the way that books work is they don't work on publicity. Getting your book in the paper doesn't change or do anything. The main thing that happens is that people read it and they think it's worthwhile and they tell someone else. And that either happens or doesn't happen. That's really the way the book spread.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Nicky. That's a good place to finish. I do recommend it. It's a thorough read. I suggest you put a week aside. Other People's Wars, New Zealand and Afghanistan, Iraq and the War on Terror. And that's by Nicky Hager. Thank you for your time, Nicky.
Good. See you.